Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Roger Anderson of the Kitchen Counter podcast and fellow Oregonian, and we're going to be discussing Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, which was awarded the Retro Hugo in 2004 for the year 1954, which gets a little confusing, but be that as it may. Roger, thank you for joining me.
Seth, I am so excited to be here to talk about this book. And am I your first non-literary guest as far as podcasting goes?
Oh, I wouldn't say so. I think there's a number of backgrounds represented so far. My last guest is a physicist, physics student anyway. I haven't posted that episode yet, so you wouldn't know that.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Excited to be here.
Yeah. And we've been talking about Ray Bradbury for quite a while, actually, because we had met through a meetup where we talked in person and we were talking about Take Me to Your Reader. And you were like, you need to do some Bradbury. And I think even before that, you had said something on Twitter. You guys should cover some Bradbury.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Bradbury fan. I'm sure we'll get into that and I'm sure I'll nerd out a bit. But yeah
sounds definitely good. So why don't you tell the listener something about yourself, about your podcast?
Yeah, I host a podcast called the Kitchen Counter Podcast. And I started this podcast, I always like to tell people I started it in, I think it was 2014, but I always say it was PS, or pre-Serial. Remember, Serial came out and all of a sudden everybody was like, oh, everybody's getting a podcast now. I started my podcast 2 months before Serial came out. But my show is about home cooking and, I don't really have a hard format or a really solid release schedule, but I just try to have fun with it. You've actually been on the show several episodes back. We talked about chili, one of my most popular episodes, by the way. Sweet. But I try to put together shows that are interesting, useful for folks who want to get into the kitchen at home and cook for themselves. So sometimes it'll be an interview with a cookbook author. Sometimes it'll be an interview with another podcaster. Sometimes it's just me going through some tips and tricks on whatever the topic du jour is. So yeah, the Kitchen Counter podcast. That's what I do in the podcasting world right now.
Cool. Well, what about, and so I don't know this about you. I know you're a Ray Bradbury fan, but I don't know how nerdy you are. So why don't you kind of give me a little history there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess I would say I'm a casual nerd.
There we go.
I cut a broad swath in nerddom, but I don't go super deep in any one thing. Mm-hmm. So, I grew up in the 80s, early 90s a little bit, of my formative years, I guess, or high school years. So a lot of my nerd history is Star Wars, Star Trek, that sort of stuff. In high school and actually earlier than that, junior high, I kind of went through a fantasy phase. Mm-hmm. So I had a bunch of friends that got together. We did things like play the Dungeons and Dragons. I got really into the fantasy books like Dragonlance, which I'd actually love to go back and read because it's been so long. And that whole universe in nerdery, if I can use that term, I love comic books, but I don't like any of the comic books that anyone else likes or are popular. I don't like superhero comics. I don't have anything against them, but I'm a huge Carl Barks fan, and Carl Barks is famous for inventing Uncle Scrooge and kind of turning Donald Duck into an adventuring character.
Nice.
And for science fiction, books, I didn't really get into science fiction books proper until I was out of high school into college.
Okay.
And again, I haven't read deeply, but I've read a lot of different things. But I've probably read Bradbury deeper than anybody in one author in science fiction. So I love pop culture. It's just with a kid, and I feel like my pop culture history froze in time around, 10 years ago. Like, you talk to me about things that are older than 10 years and I'm good. Anything recent, and I really have no idea what you're talking about. So that's my nerdy history, if that made sense.
Excellent. So with the science fiction that you've read post high school, I mean, how have you done against the benchmark that I've set for myself, and that is the list of Hugo Award winners?
So I remember looking through the list when you'd originally sent it to me, because I wasn't that familiar with the list to begin with, and I kind of went through and did a tally. And I'm certainly much, much lower than you or probably all of your guests. I've only read a handful. I think maybe three or four, but the one that really jumps out at me, and I actually talked to you about doing a show perhaps on this one, this would have been my second choice if there wasn't a Bradbury available, and that's The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin. That's one of my all-time favorite books. It's just a fantastic novel. I hope you find somebody to do that one with you soon, because I'd love to hear that. So I'm a bit of a neophyte when it comes to the Hugo list.
Okay. So why this book, Roger? I think I know the answer, but I have to ask it.
So big Ray Bradbury fan. And I think on Twitter, I might have shared with you, or maybe I just tweeted it, but I was a pretty adventurous reader when I was young. And I think if I'm not totally misremembering this, I remember reading a science fiction story, I think when I was in second grade, and mm-hmm. it turned out to be A Sound of Thunder.
Oh, nice.
You know, one of Ray Bradbury's one of his most famous stories, or at least one that reverberates in pop culture for sure.
Yeah. That's one of the early ones for me as well.
Yeah. And I didn't really get that it was Ray Bradbury. I mean, I read the name, but it didn't mean anything to me. And it kind of filed it away into my brain until years later. I think I picked up a collection of Ray Bradbury stories. Mm-hmm. And when I was reading through it, I came across A Sound of Thunder. And I thought, oh, yeah, I know this story. And it kind of reignited my interest in Ray Bradbury. And then I started reading everything I could find. And, of course, one of those things was Fahrenheit 451. And I would be happy to talk about any Bradbury work, but, Fahrenheit 451 is his dystopian novel, and it's just a lot of fun. So I was really excited to see that this was given a retro Hugo so I could talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was one reason that I actually included the retro Hugos on the list, just because I did want to talk about this book in particular. And you're aware that I did cover it on my other podcast, Take Me to Your Reader. We had Phil Nichols from the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies, mm-hmm. and we talked about the book and about the François Truffaut film. Mm-hmm. So I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes to that. But I've wanted to revisit this one. And it just happened that my son was reading it for school. And I figure as an attentive parent, I should pretty much read anything that he's reading just in case he has any questions or that kind of stuff. And it gives me an excuse to squeeze in another book. So I can't remember if I pinged you about that and said, hey, I'm reading this.
Yeah, I think you said, I am reading this book again. I think you said, you know, if you want to talk about it. I think that's how this discussion started for me coming on. So thank you so much for extending that invitation. This will be fun.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we go ahead and move into our non-spoiler synopsis of the book? Do you want to go ahead and try that?
Yeah, I could give you I was thinking about this. I have a really short one, I think, mm-hmm. worked up. And so I would say this is a novel that centers on a dystopian world of tomorrow where books are outlawed. And then firemen no longer needing to put out fires because, as luck would have it, houses are fireproof in the future. Their main task is to kind of be the authoritarian figure in society. And they are tasked with finding books and burning them. But it all kind of goes awry when one fireman starts asking questions about his, I guess, existential questions about why he's doing what he's doing. And that's kind of the framework in a really small nutshell of what the book's about.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's about far enough to go without giving too much away. Mm-hmm. I think anybody who was not at all familiar with it might be surprised about the whole, wait, firemen are doing what? I remember coming to it initially. I think I already knew that. I think that's kind of in the pop culture zeitgeist about the book. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't really consider that too spoilery.
Okay. But
we can get into more specifics later.
Okay, perfect.
So when did you first read this one? I guess you did kind of touch on that earlier.
Yeah, you know, I didn't read it in high school, but it was probably offered or required reading in one of my high school classes. But remembering the kind of high school student mm-hmm. I was, I'm sure I just didn't read it. I wasn't a great high school student.
You and I were probably very similar high school students.
Yeah, I was not an overachiever. And, you know, if only I know now, but I knew then what I know now. But I probably read this in college. I would say I was probably a freshman or a sophomore in college when I finally got around to it. I think it's because I worked at a used bookstore and it was probably on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'm gonna check this out. And that's probably when I read mm-hmm. it.
It's funny because this is one that I have known about for a really long time. And I think I got to it. I know it's after I got out of college and I picked it up on a book on tape from the library. And learned firsthand that a bad audiobook can really screw up a book, mm-hmm. Which is interesting because there's also kind of the corollary to that is that a really good audiobook narrator can show how crappy a book is. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, this book did not deserve this good of an audiobook. But yeah, I think I gave it like a 2-star review on Goodreads, And then I just picked it up a couple of years ago to talk about it. I guess it was last year to talk about it on Take Me to Your Reader, and was quite delighted that it was not the book that I remembered it being from the audiobook.
Refresh my memory, and I can't remember if we've talked about this, but what's your background with Bradbury? And I know you talked about this on your other podcast, but when you read Fahrenheit 451, was Bradbury new to you, or were you somewhat familiar with his other work?
So as I've now read more of Bradbury, I know that I definitely read some of him in high school. And we did quite a bit of short fiction in my like honors English ninth grade class, which I did mediocrely enough that I didn't have honors English 10th grade. And so it not much in that class really sunk in. And I don't think I was conscious of reading Ray Bradbury after that until, like I said, after college. And at some point I picked up that audiobook of Fahrenheit 451. And then I also picked up, like you said, a collection of his short fiction. And I think it was called R is for Rocket. Mm-hmm. And really, really enjoyed that. And so that kind of put it, it had a Sound of Thunder in there. It had a couple of the others that I had read before. And that kind of put it in my head that, okay, this guy is an amazing writer. And so at some point I need to get back to him. But yeah, it's, I can't say that I was ever an enormous Bradbury fan from a long time ago. It's just very recently that I realized that this guy was a master.
Yeah. And what's interesting, I think short story Bradbury is the best Bradbury. And he has written novels. A lot of his novels happen to be stitched together collections of short stories that he's previously published. This is one of those novels that he's written, though, that's actually kind of a standalone. It's not a series of short stories. It's a true quote unquote novel. But it kind of reads like a short story, and I'm sure we'll get into this. And maybe that's because I'm just used to Bradbury's style, but,
Well, and that part of that may be from the origins of the book. We went over a bit of this on mm-hmm. Take Me to Your Reader. I don't want to totally recapitulate it if people want to go listen to that, but there is, a collection of stories called A Pleasure to Burn. Mm-hmm. And it basically shows the evolution of Bradbury's writing from the early stories where he had this idea into like the last version of The Fireman, which was the kind of the seed of this story or of this book. And I definitely recommend it because it's just interesting to see him beginning to riff on it and expand the story out before putting it into novel format, which it's still quite a brief novel.
Yeah, we were talking about this before we recorded. I mean, the paperback version I have is from, I think, 1970 or something. Because what this book was written in 53, I think, if I remember. Yeah. And, I mean, my book's only 147 pages. And it's really an afternoon read if you committed yourself to it. It's not a hard read.
Absolutely.
It reads really well. His writing is so good. I mean, it's really a pleasure to read.
Yes, that's what I put in my Goodreads review, and which is reminiscent of the first line of the book. It was a pleasure to burn. And this summer when my son was reading it, or I guess this spring, I think I sat down and read it in an afternoon, and it's not really a very daunting one to get through. I mean, any book that you've previously read is easier to read the next time.
Sure.
Because you know what you're getting. I can't say any book. If you read something like Jurassic Park, where there's a lot of nuts and bolts, hard science fiction, I find, is harder to read the second time. But that's just because you're like, I don't want to do the homework here. Just get on with the story and stop telling me about rivets.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned that too, because I think this book is probably, and I haven't read all of Bradbury's work, but I've read most of it. I haven't read a lot of his really later, you know, the stuff he wrote later in his life, but this is probably his hardest, or one of his quote unquote hardest science fiction. And by the standards of true hard science fiction writers, it's not hard science fiction at all. But for Bradbury, it's definitely on that end of the spectrum. And I think Bradbury gets unfairly, I want to say unfairly, that's the wrong way to put it. I mean, he's not so much a science fiction writer, as he is a fantasy writer or like a, I don't know. I think he sometimes gets unfairly maligned as a science fiction writer because he doesn't quite follow the Arthur C. Clarke or the Isaac Asimov or the it's just so different. He's almost a genre of his own. He takes bits and pieces.
I agree. Yeah, definitely. And you know, when you think of science fiction, you know, the big three are always Asimov, Heinlein, and Clarke, right? Bradbury is in there somewhere, but I think he kind of escaped the trap of being just a science fiction writer. And he does have a lot of novels and stories and stuff that definitely are not science fiction. And in fact, in order to refresh for the podcast here, I listened to the audiobook that's read by Ray Bradbury himself, which by any standard of an audiobook is not a very good one, because Bradbury is not a fluent audiobook narrator. It has this very grandfatherly quality to it. It's like being read to by a beloved uncle or aunt or grandparent. But the last disc on that is actually just an interview about Bradbury's life and his work and about Fahrenheit 451 itself. And he actually mentions on that interview that he considers this his only science fiction book. Ah. Everything else he figures is fantasy.
Okay. I think that's probably a fair assessment. And actually, my favorite Ray Bradbury work, although I love this book, are his sort of magical realism stories, where I guess you could call them fantasy, but ones that take place in actual historical locations. I think, we could talk about all sorts of Ray Bradbury stuff, but he's amazing. So
I guess we've kind of moved over into overall thoughts about the book. You know, we're going to get into spoilers in a little bit. And at this point, if you haven't read this book, like we've said, it's an easy read. I mean, not that it's shallow by any stretch of the imagination. It's definitely a deep book, but it's one that goes down easy. And like you said, it's a pleasure to read. So absolutely, if you're out there, pick this one up. It will reward your reading.
And you know what's funny too is when I reread this, I haven't actually read this through for many years. And so reading it through with like an older perspective, an older person's perspective, or a more mature perspective, I can see how this book might come across as maybe a little bit trite, or a little bit like, oh yeah, that was an easy. I mean, it's almost as if you read it now without ever having read it, it might come across as a little hackneyed or a little overdone or cliche, I guess is the word I'm looking for. But I think when Bradbury wrote it, it wasn't. He wrote it a few years after 1984. There's a lot of similar themes, but I think it was very, new and fresh when he wrote it. But I just a kind of a word of caution if people read it and they say like, oh yeah, burning books, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anytime you read anything that's super, super classic, you're going to be like, oh, this is derivative of all these other things I've read. When in fact, it's just so influential that you've seen it in a million.
Right. Exactly. Everything else is derives from it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so if you were to recommend this book to people other than just everyone, on what basis would you recommend it? You know, fans of other properties, what do you think?
You know, I was thinking about this. I don't really know of other properties per se, but what I, you know, maybe a little Blade Runner-ish light, because you kind of have that weird idea of, and I don't want to get into spoilers just yet, but that weird idea of this authoritarian figures, you know, on the hunt for other folks. But I would say in general, if you're a fan of dystopian universes, like 1984, for example, or even like maybe Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, which has some more historical context, you would like this. And I think what really kind of freaked me out, Seth, when I went back and read this, is how prescient the themes in it are. And we're going to talk about it in a minute. But
yeah,
it's almost more on point now than I imagine it might have been when Bradbury was writing it, you know, in the wake of European Nazism and Stalinism. I guess what I'm saying is you don't have to go very far to find real world examples of these dystopian societies that Ray Bradbury kind of captures so well. And I'm a fan of those sorts of books and histories. So for me, this fits right in that wheelhouse. So I think if you're interested in that, you're going to love this book.
Yeah. And I would say if you love language, I feel like Bradbury deploys it very well. And we can talk more about some passages that we really like. But his prose is tremendous. I love the way he
writes with a poet's ear. I mean, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, is it time to get into spoilers, Roger? Okay. So you have been warned, dear listener. So just freeform discussion. Anything you want to talk about, Roger?
Yeah. So where to start? There's so much.
Exactly.
I wrote down a few points and we can bounce back and forth. I know you've got some you want to talk about too.
Sure. Yeah, but I want you to kind of guide the conversation. I'll respond to you. Like you said, I'll jump in, But really what you want to talk about, that's the thing.
Okay, cool. So one of the things I really liked about this book, again, when I went back and reread it, so the protagonist is a fireman named Guy Montag. And right. He's the one I alluded to in the synopsis, right, that he kind of has a moment of existential crisis when the book opens. I think the first line in it, I don't have it right in front of me, but it was a pleasure to burn. I think you mentioned that.
Right.
And yeah. It starts out introducing Montag as hardcore. He's into the mission of the firemen, finding books, burning them. And I think Ray Bradbury does a really great job with Montag's character arc, because if you look at it from a viewpoint of somebody that's having kind of it's almost like he's having a conversion or a deconversion event in his life. You know, he has a sure. moment of doubt. And, of course, that's the fulcrum upon which the entire novel, you know, pivots. I think he handles it very well. And we can talk about some mm-hmm. of the interesting plot devices that Bradbury uses. But I think the whole novel would break down if he didn't really use Montag. As well as he did. I don't know if that kind of a half-formed thought, but that's like the first thing that jumps out at me about this book.
Yeah, I'd never really thought of it in those terms of either a conversion or a deconversion. And the fact that there's a King James Bible that plays such a large role mm-hmm. As he's, you know, trying to read it on the train and talking to Faber about it, that's fascinating. That's an interesting resonance in there that I'd never really noticed.
Yeah, it's almost like this moment of skepticism starts him on a dangerous path, right? Because that gets him into trouble. You find out later that he'd already had these moments, right? Because he's been squirreling books yes. away already. You don't know this until it gets a little later on. But there's the moment when he's out on a call and they go to I can't remember her name or if she even had one, but it was the old woman's house, right?
Yeah.
And the firemen tell her, you know, get out of the house. We know you've got books in there. And you know, to encapsulate it, she refuses. And she basically says, look, if you want to burn the books, you're going to have to burn me with it. And they give her a couple of chances, but they end up doing it. And that yeah. moment has such an impact in Montag's life. It just flips a switch and he doesn't see anything quite the same way. I mean, he just wonders, you know, what could yeah. be in these books that would be so important that somebody would give up their life for them.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting too, because it's a quote from Fox's Book of Martyrs that she gives. And so that's another little link in the chain of I'm not calling this a religious book, 'cause I don't think Bradbury was a religious man. But that theme of conversion or deconversion.
Yeah. And actually, one of the interesting, so I listened, I read the book again, and then I went back and I listened to an audiobook that was narrated by Tim Robbins. So it had a little mm-hmm. more of an actor's flavor, and it was well done. I recommend it. And when I listened mm-hmm. to the book, one of the things that really stuck in my mind, so I remember when Montag's burning the books, and one, I can't remember if it like flutters past his face or he picks it up and he reads, and he feels almost so guilty, but he accidentally or probably intentionally reads a sentence. Do you remember that part?
Right. Once upon a time.
No, it's what he read was, "Time has fallen asleep in the afternoon sunshine."
That's right.
And when he read that, and I know I don't have the novel in front of me, but that's an actual line from a real novel, not a Bradbury novel. But yeah. that almost gave me chills, because I think when Bradbury picked that sentence, it so perfectly put out there, you know, the power of literature and how it can yes. make you feel. And as Beatty, the fire captain, we'll talk about later, he's like, that's nonsense. What does that even mean? It doesn't mean anything. Right. And it was just a very powerful moment. And that, again, kind of sets that spark, no pun intended, in Montag's mind. There's something more to this, and I don't know what it is, but something's going on.
Yeah. And talking about that audiobook with that last disc and the interview of Ray Bradbury, he talked about how he wrote the book in a library and he kept, you know, sprinting through the library to find books to quote.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which is a great mental image of an author at work.
And a really quick aside on that, if you're interested in Bradbury's work, or if anybody's listening is interested in Bradbury's work or the nature of creativity in general, you absolutely have to go get yourself a copy of his book, Zen and the Art of Writing. It's a collection of essays on creativity, mostly about his creative process. And the essay on writing Fahrenheit 451 is in there, and all sorts of other. It's an incredibly inspirational book. You don't have to be a writer to get a lot out of it, but it's I mean, it's like having a master sit you down and just say, this is how creativity works. It's elusive and you have to feed the muses and all that. Yeah. But it's really good. He talks about going to the UCLA library and paying, you know, using dimes. They were pay typewriters. He'd pop a dime in and he could type for an hour or whatever it was. It's really great.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I really like about this book, I don't know how you feel about all of the characters. I think they're all wonderfully realized, but by far my absolute favorite character, and he's almost more of a plot device than a character in some ways, is Fire Captain Beatty.
Yes.
Because there's a moment where he has this, I would call it a monologue. Some people might call it a period of like exposition where he's kind of helping us, the reader, understand what the world is like and how it came to be that books were illegal and should be burned. And the ideas, it's really about the ideas contained within the books that were dangerous, not the books, because sure. They say there's still technical manuals and comic books around. But he does this, Bradbury does this great thing where he has a scene of high tension, you know, when Montague calls in sick, right? The next day after they burn that woman alive, he doesn't know what to do. And he calls in sick and you find out that he took a book from that house. He grabbed one, yes. Right? And snuck it home and he's beside himself. He doesn't know what to do, but he has to think. So he calls in sick.
Right.
And, lo and behold, Fire Captain Beatty shows up at his house. And I love this setup where Montague is in bed sick. His wife, Mildred, is there and she's clueless. She doesn't know he has a book and, right. It's under his pillow. I mean, he's laying on the book, right? It's under his pillow and Fire Captain Beatty shows up and Mildred's, you know, fooling around with Montague, trying to get him comfortable. She keeps patting the pillow and rearing and he's like, leave me alone. You know, he's just terrified that she's going to lift the pillow up and a book's going to fall out right in front of the fire captain. But Beatty gives this exposition on the way things were. But I think Bradbury was so genius to interlace it with this period of high tension so it doesn't get boring. I don't think it's boring anyway, but it's one of the greatest, like monologues, I think, in science fiction, when Beatty explains why the world is the way it is.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because you get a counterpoint where when Montague goes to Faber, he gets a different angle on essentially the same story. How did the world come to be this way? Mm-hmm. And because Beatty gives the whole monologue, and it's often misunderstood because it uses the word minorities, mm-hmm. where what Beatty is saying is that people were offended at books. And that's what he's saying. Any group that was offended by a book, he's calling minorities. So if, mm-hmm. If a Christian group was offended at a book or at something like The Last Temptation of Christ, you know, I'm thinking of like old movies, mm-hmm. You know, then they're just like, well, fine, burn it. If it offends people, we'll get rid of it. And they just, you know, piecemeal did that one by one. But then in the, discussion with Faber, he talks about the fact that we had already stopped reading before we started burning the books. The firemen didn't come along and take away the books. We just stopped reading them. And that allowed them to come in and start doing this.
Yeah. It was almost like the firemen were just filling a vacuum. They were just serving a need that the people already wanted, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great point. I didn't think about it that way. I also think it's ironic that the Beatty, and I presume the other fire chiefs are, Beatty's obviously very well read. Because if there's one point, yes. where he's just quoting from memory, apparently, you know, long passages from books, you know, kind of doing the point counterpoint where he's just going on and Montague's like mind.
Right. He's doing both sides of the argument, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
He's like, I'm recounting a dream that I had about you where we had a big argument.
That's right. That's right.
And that's another great tense scene because at that point he has Faber in his ear who's trying to keep him from falling.
Yeah, this is the second time, right, that Beatty comes to him.
This is when Montague comes into the station and burns a book, right? Puts a book in the incinerator.
Oh, right. Yeah, Beatty says, you know, at one point in every fireman's life, they have this question and they might take a book home and read it, but, you know, they always come to their senses and bring it in and burn it. And so that's a great moment, too, when Montague is kind of having this inner crisis where he's like, what? Because he has a whole cache of books at home, right? And he's like, which book? First of all, does he know which book I took? So that's a risky. If I bring back a different book, he'll know I have more than one. But even if he doesn't, how do I decide which book is less worthy of redemption than another? And I can't remember the exact, but it's like, is Mr. Jefferson less worthy than you know, Mr. Hemingway. I mean, how do you decide which book burns and which doesn't? It's really fascinating.
Yeah, and that is really a tremendous scene. And I have to agree with you that Beatty is, in a lot of ways, the more compelling character. He's interesting because you wonder, where did this guy come from? And going back to that interview again, and I apologize, I keep doing this, but I think people should check out that audiobook, if for nothing else, for that interview. Bradbury actually ended up writing a whole backstory for Beatty after the book was published, as he was adapting it for the stage. Mm. And he said he was tempted a few times to go back and add that stuff to the book, but he commented that he doesn't think that an author should disagree with his younger self.
Right.
Which I think is right on, actually. I think the book should stay as it is. Yeah.
And then the other thing, I'm just kind of picking out points here, but I think, you know, we talk a lot about science fiction predicting the future or foreshadowing the future. And even though it's not hard science fiction and there's not a lot of technology that's very technical, Bradbury gets so much right.
Yeah.
About society today or in the future. And I'm sure this was happening right when he was alive and writing this in the early 50s, late 40s or whatever, when he was putting all this stuff together. Mm-hmm. But just the, like, Mildred, right, is kind of Montague's wife, Mildred, encapsulates kind of this idea of don't think too deeply about things. You know, just try to make yourself happy. You know, turn on the walls, which, you know, aren't a far cry away from our really mega large LCD TVs. You know, turn on the walls and let your family come in, the family being the actors, you know, and they're your family. And he talks about the seashells, right? The basically Apple earbuds or
exactly.
Pieces that you put in and listen. And the scene where Montague is kind of having this existential crisis and he comes home to find, I think she's laying on her bed with her seashells in her ears, and you can hear the insect skittering, or however Bradbury so perfectly describes it.
Yeah.
And I think at that point I think it was sleeping pills she had overdosed on.
Yes.
And Montague has to call. I mean, it's like the Roto-Rooter guys. Apparently it's so common for this to happen. There's these two kind of cold technicians that show up, and the way Bradbury describes that whole scene is absolutely chilling.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
It is so, I don't even know. I can't describe it any better than he could, but the way he talks about the snake, they have to pump her stomach and these technicians send the snake down into the pit of her stomach. It's just, it's terrifying. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. The seashell radios are interesting, because yeah, that's well ahead of any kind of state of the art technology, that existed in the '50s. And we, you know, I walk around with Bluetooth headphones on all the time.
Yeah, you have a little Faber in your ear wherever you go.
Yep. And usually, you know, it's podcasts. It might be you, Roger.
That's true. Likewise. Yeah, yeah. But these themes, I think, are just fascinating, because I think Bradbury, in his other works, I don't want to say he was a Luddite or anti-technology, but I think he did feel that television was not a great use of time, even though a lot of his work adapted for television. But so you could really see kind of this theme of like how technology breeds isolation. Mm-hmm. And again, so prescient today, right? Everybody's walking around with their faces buried on their smartphones or whatever, or on their tablets. And I mean, he was so right on that. And the other theme, which Beatty talks about, kind of this anti-intellectualism, right? Which seems to be, for whatever crazy reason, gaining a real foothold in the 21st century.
Yep.
And if I think for a lot of the same reasons that Beatty expounds in his monologue. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's shocking.
Yeah.
What did you think about The Hound?
I thought that was really interesting. I like the fact that he doesn't try for hard science fiction there. Mm-hmm. He describes that it's mechanical and it's got six legs, I think. But he doesn't talk about vacuum tubes, and maybe he does, but hard science fiction, the problem is when it's wrong, it's really wrong. And that's mm-hmm. Sometimes I have a segment on the show called Wild Speculation, where we talk about the most completely out there or completely missed guesses and about the future. And so I feel like the mechanical hound is a creature of menace, and he really does bring out that menace, especially because early on it's already not a fan of Montag for some reason.
which I think is fascinating. And then the fact that it becomes the antagonist further on in the book is interesting.
Yeah, I've always wondered, because it's not ever really clear in the book how early on, I don't think it is anyway, how early on Montag has been hiding books. You only know that you only come to realize that it's not just the one he took from that day. He's got a whole, his heater vents full of them, right? Or whatever. His furnace, the tunnels.
You get the impression he hasn't read them until the events of the book.
Exactly. It's like he's been squirreling away. It's almost like sticks of dynamite, right? He's been squirreling away. He has no idea what to do with them. He just knows that for whatever reason, he's compelled to hide them away. I almost wonder if the Hound all along knew, like from the first time Montag took a book home, well before the period in the novel.
Yeah, or if Beatty knew.
Yeah, I suspect they probably did, because there's one scene early on, if I remember right, where Montag hears the Hound, or what sounds like the Hound, skittering around outside the house. And that might have been after the moment he takes the one book home. But you have to wonder if the Hound just wasn't on to Montag from the beginning, but maybe the other firemen were giving Montag the benefit of the doubt. But Beatty certainly was a clever operator, and he was probably, I suspect, on to Montag for a long time. And when he saw the woman burn in the house, and he kind of, that was a tipping point for him. I think Beatty was he saw the writing on the wall, and he's like, I've got to intervene now.
Yeah. And I guess we should probably mention Clarice. We haven't actually talked about her, because she's one of the other tipping points, right? She's someone who's different, very, like, as different from his wife as possible, right? She's younger and interested in looking up at the stars and, you know, tasting the rain and smelling leaves, interested in the world rather than, you know, the television screens and the house.
Yeah, that you're right. We should talk about her, because she does play a very important early role in the novel, and she delivers one of the great lines of the book. I think I don't have it written down, so I'm going from memory, but it's something to the effect of Montag, and this might have been the second or third or however many times he runs into her on the way home from work, right? She's out walking, or the way to work, and he says, I feel like I've known you for a long time. And she says, well, that's because I like you and I don't want anything from you.
Right.
And that was such an alien concept to Montag. He just didn't know what to make of it. And it was a beautiful, it's just a beautiful line about relationships. You know, that's a relationship he never, maybe early on he had with his wife, but he certainly doesn't now. And Clarice, like you said, is the opposite of his wife in any way, in every way. And it just, it makes it so glaringly obvious to Montag that what he is not happy.
Yeah. Yeah, where he hadn't considered that before.
Or she mentions that, did you know there's dew on the grass in the mornings?
Yeah.
Did you know that? And Montag is irritated, not because he didn't know it. It's that he couldn't remember if he knew that. And that irritated him, because it's like, why don't I know that? I should know that.
Yeah, and that comes into some of the stuff that Faber talks about leisure. Before that, though, I did want to mention one thing that I really like about the book is it's very hard to pin down how long the book takes place over. He uses this device of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if he means literally it was a week, or if he's just saying time flew by. And so I'm not at all certain that the book just, you know, takes place over the course of 2 or 3 weeks, or if it takes place over 6 months. I don't know, but I like that about it.
That's interesting, because I just always took for granted that it took place in a very compressed amount of time. But that's an interesting way to look at it. I hadn't thought about that either. That's really interesting.
Well, the other interesting thing I think is the more I read the book, the more I think about it, the more I think this society cannot have lasted very long at this point. It's got to be relatively young to have someone like Beatty who knows kind of some of the history of books, but they've done such an effective job of indoctrinating people that they can say things like Benjamin Franklin was the founder of the firefighters, which is true, of course. I mean, he was somebody who was on board originally, I guess was one of the original founders of fire brigades, but for the purpose of course, putting out fires. But they've rewritten the history to the point that all of this goes back to the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Either that or it's alternate history. That's another interesting question.
It could be alternate history. And the other thing we haven't talked about, there's so much to talk about, that is a crazy, scary parallel to today, but also plays a big part of in the resolution of the novel, is that the other thing about society in this world is that war is a constant presence.
Yes.
And I know it was a bit of a jump in the track there, but I just thought, you know, that today, you know, we don't even think twice about a plane flying to another country and dropping bombs. Well, in the Fahrenheit world, there are bombers flying overhead, and war, I think wars last for a day or something like that, but it's a constant. It's like constant low level anxiety in this world. There's never peace. There's never time to relax or have leisure.
Right. But they're very blasé about it too, right? Where they're talking about, oh, it'll be a quick war, you know, no big deal. And if my husband dies, you know, I'll remarry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's that whole talk in the parlor with Mildred and all her friends, mm-hmm. where he scandalizes them by reading books to them.
Yeah, where he takes a dangerous turn and he goes probably too far, at least in Faber's mind, right? He's like, what are you doing, you idiot? You're blowing the whole game here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the leisure thing, that was something that I definitely wanted to talk about, because when Faber first mentions it to him, he says, well, we've got all kinds of leisure. And I think I wrote it down here. He said you need leisure, you need quality information, leisure to digest it, and the right to act on it. And the leisure to digest it, of course, means time that isn't filled with other things. And it reminded me of, I had a friend that I worked with, and I was always telling him about books that I was reading. And he asked me, how do you find time to read so many books? And I said, well, I just read in the evening and, you know, in the morning sometimes and at lunch. He's like, yeah, but why do you read? And I said, because I feel like it's good for my brain. And he expressed to me that he felt like reading a novel would be a waste of time that he could spend doing something else, like reading a technical book, reading something that would help him develop his career. And so I asked him, well, are you reading technical books? And he said, no, mostly I just watch Netflix. So that was a kind of an example of him not seizing that leisure time that he could have because he didn't find value in just reading. And I feel like reading is an end in itself.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And I think, and is Bradbury's characters in this book later on. I mean, I think they even say, like, there's a point, right, where Montague, he gets himself into trouble and he's got to flee town, basically, right? Because we should probably mention it. Should we mention that pivotal part of the novel where after he gets together with Faber, he crafts a plan. And it's a bit of a harebrained plan, but Faber's extremely excited. And he's like, this is the first, you know, exciting thing good idea. I can't remember what he says exactly that anyone's ever had. And this plan is that Montague has now seen the light, and mm-hmm. through the help of Faber's guidance. And his plan is, I believe, if I'm getting this quite right, he's going to go to the homes of firemen around the city and plant books and call them in. Right.
Right.
And he's going to like start this internal combustion of the firemen's organization by doing this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't quite go as planned because he stops by his house and he kind of goes off the rails with Mildred and his friends. And at that point, I think he goes back to the firehouse. Is that when he goes back to the firehouse and has the confrontation with Beatty? And then they're playing poker or something like that. And then and a call comes in and they don't tell Montague anything about it. Right. And they're like, let's go. You need to go on this call. And they end up going to Montague's house. Of course, right. He didn't know they were doing that until they got there. And it turns out, evidently, that Mildred had called it because he had let her in on the secret eventually. And she had called in the fact that he had books and she was out of his life. And there's a big confrontation.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I think you might have had you get the order a little backwards there because it's out of those events after he, you know, not to sugarcoat it in any way, murders Beatty mm-hmm. with the flamethrower, even though Beatty more or less committed suicide by cop in a way.
Yeah, he did.
But then when he flees there, he goes to Faber and he starts his little harebrained plot at that point. And it's okay. Too little too late, really, because he's already a man on the run. But that whole sequence, I will say, I asked my son, what was your favorite part of the book? And I don't know whether I should be disturbed by this or not. But the scene, the way Bradbury describes Beatty being burned was the scene that stuck out to my son because it's very vivid. And I'm like, is my son a pyro? I need to know if my son's a pyro because I totally was. And so I mean, I never burned a house down or anything, though I did, my friend and I once, I should put a link, I wrote a blog post about this a while back. When I turned 40, I did some blog posts reminiscing about stupid crap I did when I was a kid. And my friend and I decided one time that we would build a fire. And we built it right up against his house. The fact that it was aluminum siding kept us from causing major, major property damage. But
see, that a precursor to the dystopian future houses no longer burn. Seth, you were there.
Whoa, Anchorage, Alaska. That's where Fahrenheit 451 is set.
Yeah.
I can't remember where I was going with that whole lead up to that incident where he eventually murders Beatty. But then he goes on the lam. Oh, that's right. And at some point he meets a group of refugees that Faber lets him in on, right? Or tells him about out in the forest. And they explain to him that, look, it's not the books. The books really are inconsequential. It's the ideas. It's the ideas that are contained in the book that are the dangerous thing and that we have to preserve because, sorry, my cat's meowing. They have to preserve because she's a Ray Bradbury fan too. They have to preserve because they're memorizing books, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah.
So when they presume that one day society will collapse, the end of the civilizations we know will happen, they'll be the ones that have to go in and rebuild and they'll have memorized everything. It doesn't matter that they don't have the physical book. They've got all of the content in their brains.
Right. I'm not sure that I totally buy that. But it doesn't bother me.
Yeah. And to tell you the truth, from that point forward in the book, I mean, it's a good novel. That point forward in the ending, my older self, it doesn't really satisfy me.
Sure.
It felt a little too neat, mm-hmm. a little too bow-tied in a way.
The fact that the war begins and ends right then.
The war begins and ends. It conveniently destroys everybody, presumably that Montague knew. Probably Mildred is gone and hopefully Faber made it out. And now they can go back in and rebuild society. Anyway, it just seems a little too perfect. I mean, even though it's not anywhere near a perfect scenario, but for the book, it's a little too clean, I think.
One thing that I always find interesting about the scholars in the forest is there's almost a kind of anti-science, anti-technology thing there where they're talking about how, yeah, I was a professor of philosophy and they took, you know, my lecture hall and turned it into an engineering lecture hall. And then I was I was teaching poetry and they took that and they turned it into a chemistry lab or something. I'm a science guy, right? I have a technology degree. And so I feel like there shouldn't be a necessarily one without the other, right? It's great to have scientists, but it's also great to have the humanities and have literature and have deeper things to think about.
That's a great you say that too, because I had a thought a while back when I was thinking about this. It's kind of the rise of, like, there's nothing wrong with the STEM, you know, idea, the science, technology, what's the E stand for?
Mathematics.
Engineering and mathematics. Thank you. Kind of to the detriment of the humanities or the liberal arts, because I'm a liberal arts grad, although I love science, I'm pro-science. But I always grumble when people are like, what are you going to do with a liberal arts degree? It's, whatever you want to do. I mean, I don't understand why you're not going to be in a chemistry lab, you know,
right,
binding proteins to I don't even know what. No, you're not going to be doing that unless you get a chemistry degree or whatever. But, you know, this idea that the humanities and the liberal arts are generally worthless in today's society. It kind of goes back to your coworker and the comments that, you know, you heard from him. It's really unfortunate, I think.
Yeah.
Because exactly to your point, why does it have to be mutually exclusive? Doesn't the humanities inform how we use technology?
Yeah. I mean, because science and that kind of stuff, right, tells us facts, but things like the humanities, you know, philosophy, art, literature, helps us know how to think. Mm-hmm. So it's good to know knowledge, but it's also good to know how to think.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm glad you said that because you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. I like this quote from Faber. He says, it's not books at all you're looking for. Take it where you can find it, in old phonograph records, old motion pictures, and in old friends. Look for it in nature and look for it in yourself. Books were only one type of receptacle where we stored a lot of things we were afraid we might forget. There's nothing magical in them at all. The magic is only in what books say, how they stitch the patches of the universe together in one garment for us.
There you go. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot more things to talk about, Roger.
Yeah, I agree. And boy, I think I mentioned this to you before. I mean, you could do, not you specifically, but anyone really could do an entire Ray Bradbury podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And there would be enough material. You'd never get through it all. Even if you did like a story an episode, you'd be in the high hundreds, I think, before you got anywhere near the end.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, this book alone, I mean, again, I think the themes can come across as a little trite or a little cliched, but for the very reasons you mentioned, it has such an outsized impact, I think, on pop culture, as does Bradbury. And, you know, it's the height of irony that Fahrenheit 451 is always showing up on banned book lists.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
very much.
It's as if, you know, much to Bradbury's chagrin when he was alive, you know, if you can find them, or if there's a collection of them somewhere, a lot of the different editions of Fahrenheit 451 have different codas and introductions by Bradbury. Mm-hmm. And there's one I couldn't find. I have a couple copies of this book and I couldn't find this particular one, but there's a great introduction in it where he talks about when he found out that there were editions of his books. I can't remember the publishers, Ballantine or Bantam House, Random House. Or they were publishing his book without the word, I think, hell or damn or something like that in it.
Yeah.
And it infuriated him. And he demanded that they stop doing that and put out the unexpurgated versions. And anyway, he had a really great introduction that talked about this. And he actually, interestingly, echoed a lot of the themes that Beatty talks about. It was almost like I could hear then Ray Bradbury as Beatty.
Yes.
For all of Beatty's faults, I think Beatty really speaks with Ray Bradbury's voice, the more I think about it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of the Bradbury warning you, here's where it could go. And one of the themes of the book is that society is fragile, and it's more fragile than we think. And it doesn't take much. There's a tipping point where when you get into illiteracy, and I'm not talking about illiteracy where there are people who can't read. I'm talking about people who don't want to read. And innumerancy even, anti-scientific sentiments, where mm-hmm. you can have scientists say, hey, by the way, we've been studying this thing and here's what's happening. And you have 40% of the people, 60% of the people saying, yeah, we don't trust you. We that's fake news. Not to get too political about it, but that's the kind of thing that pushes us toward the brink, you know, mm-hmm. not being able to think critically and not being able to recognize when opinion is happening and when fact is being presented. Mm-hmm. It drives me crazy.
Yeah. And these are, again, themes that are these are the themes of this book. And it's, again, scary how right on Bradbury happens to be in this day and age.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely. If you have not read this book, you really owe it to yourself to go give it a try. If you're a super hard science fiction person, it might turn you off, because I know people who are, they don't really like Ray Bradbury for that reason. But,
I mean, a lot of folks are very specific about what they like in science fiction. They're like, right, I like military science fiction, or I like you said, you know, Red Mars and The Martian and nuts and bolts science fiction. Or I like a broad umbrella. That's one thing I like about the whole list of Hugos, is it's got entries from a lot of different genres, subgenres.
Yeah, and I would say if Orwell's 1984 is of interest to you, I probably would not consider that science fiction. But if that's of interest to you, then this book definitely will be of interest to you, even though it's not hard science fiction. So I wouldn't approach it as science fiction personally. It just happens to be, I think maybe alternate history, like you mentioned earlier, might be a more appropriate frame.
Yeah. Well, anything else you want to talk about, Roger, or you want to move to final thoughts?
I think that there's a lot we could talk about. We could go on for a while, but we're probably good for final thoughts.
Okay. Well, and we've kind of been moving that way anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So by way of final thoughts, how about this? If you were in the forest with the scholars, what book or what thing do you think you would be the representative for, based on kind of your history?
Holy smokes. Oh, wow. That is an absolutely awesome question.
I probably should have prepared you for that one.
Wow. That's an awesome question. Well, let me think about that for just a second. I've never ever thought about that question before. And it's a totally different question than, like, if you could only read one book for the rest of your life.
Right.
Oh, wow. Well,
with the age of your son, it's probably some children's book.
Yeah, at this point, yeah, it's probably Dragons Love Tacos or something like that. But maybe that's a good one to leave it with. Well, as I mentioned at the outset, I am a big Bradbury fan, but I'm also a big Carl Barks fan. So I could probably rewrite some Donald Duck comic books for him, I'm sure. Even though comic books, Beatty would think that was okay.
Yes, because comic books, of course, were perfectly acceptable in that society. Comic books were fine. Yeah, and technical manuals.
What about you?
Oh, there's several candidates. I mean, one of my previous episodes, we talked about Speaker for the Dead, and that's one that I've read a bunch of times and I've listened to it a bunch of times. And I can quote large passages of that book. I just think it's amazing. So, and I've actually read the Bible a number of times, and there's some passages there that I could definitely quote.
Well, and as the refugees, the scholars noted, you don't have to know it all. You just have to know what you know, and they'll piece it together for you.
Yes, I do like I kind of one more circle back. I like the scene when Montag is on the train and he's trying to read from Ecclesiastes or something. He's reading something out of the Bible that he has, and there's that annoying earworm of an ad that keeps coming up for toothpaste.
Right.
And I just reading it makes me
dentifrist or something like that.
Yeah, denim's dentifrist, I think. Just reading that makes me tense. It makes me think of the way I feel when I'm trying to read a book, like in a cafe, which of course other people have a right to be in that cafe. It's just if they could be quiet, that'd be great.
Yes, thankfully, yeah.
And so, like, I'll shove my headphones in and blast classical music or something to drown out the Muzak and the other people. The worst is when it's somebody on a conversation on a telephone loudly. Because,
oh, yeah. There's nothing worse than hearing one half of a conversation. That's way more distracting than hearing a full conversation.
Yeah, it's uniquely distracting because your mind is trying to fill in the other half of the conversation.
Right, right.
But yeah, I can totally identify with Montag, which is just like, shut up. So, yeah, that's me reading in public places instead of going someplace quiet.
Yeah, yep. You read where you can, man.
Yeah. Actually, a while back, there's kind of a little quiet room on one of the floors in my building, and it's got a couch and it's got a couple chairs. And lots of times at lunch, you know, I'd go eat my lunch and then go to that room and find one of those chairs and just sit there and read a book. And I'm trying to read a book, and there's somebody who's sitting at a table in that quiet place. And I think she's just texting somebody, and she has her notification sound, and it's this sharp bell sound. And I just thought, you're sitting there looking at the phone. There's no way you need an audible notification on right now.
That drives me nuts too. And I have not had an audible notification turn on my phone for probably 5 years straight. I just don't, anywhere I'm at, I just don't have it on because I hate the sound of my own phone ringing.
Me too. I tweeted about it the other day. I'm like, why would you ever need an audible notification?
Yeah.
Well, so Roger, how can people find you?
Probably the easiest way would be maybe on Twitter, and I am there at TKC Podcast. That's probably the easiest, quickest way to get a hold of me. They can go to my website as well at kitchencounterpodcast.com.
Cool. Yeah, and I really like what you're doing there, where you don't have like a set thing that you do. Sometimes it's we're going to talk about roasting, or we're going to talk about reducing sauces, and then have a recipe that goes with that. Or like you said earlier, right, an interview with a cookbook author, or a discussion with another podcaster about your top five favorite sandwiches.
Yeah, I wish I could say that's all by design, Seth, but 100 plus episodes in, I'm still trying to figure this whole thing out.
I really like it, just because it's –
Thank you.
Yeah, it keeps you guessing, and I've never listened to one and gone, well, that was a waste of time.
It's also a little reflective of kind of my all over the place personality. I can't really drill deep into anything. It seems like I have to. I'm constantly getting bored and jumping around. So that's probably why I do it.
Well, and cooking is a broad enough canvas too. You've got plenty more room to paint.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, Roger, I really want to thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. You were an early encourager of me with Take Me to Your Reader, and I've wanted to talk to you about science fiction for quite some time. So this was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, maybe down the line you can pick from the other 60 or so non-Bradbury titles when I start having repeat guests.
Sounds good.
All right, cool. Well, thanks again. Bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion. And if you take nothing else away from it, I think safe to say Roger and I would say absolutely read this book if you haven't already. It's tremendous. It's a very quick read. Like I said, I read it in basically one sitting this summer. So I'm not even really that fast of a reader. And also, of course, check out the Kitchen Counter podcast. I'll put links to all of his information in the show notes. Roger has episodes, like you said, on a bunch of different cooking topics, great interviews, cookbook reviews. It's a terrific podcast. Really, really enjoy it. And before I sign off, I do want to ask you if you would please leave us a review in the iTunes store, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and connect with us on social media. Twitter is probably the best place to find me. It's at Hugo's Podcast. And if you'd give us a follow and a retweet, that'd be great. You can also find us online, hugospodcast.com. I've got plenty of guests lined up for future episodes, but if you're out there and want to come on, do drop me a line on Twitter or send an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or fill out the contact form on the website. My next guest actually reached out to me that way, so it does work. And I think that about wraps it up for this time. So thanks so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time.